Should you ever set foot outside of the motel, you will be shot.
Don't miss the new Showtime limited series based on the international bestseller.
For the last 4 years, I've been a prisoner.
Why are they keeping you here?
Starring Emmy Award winner Ewan McGregor.
This is the brave new world that you dreamt of.
Be very careful. You are still a prisoner here.
Everything in this new world comes at cost.
This is still my country.
A Gentleman in Moscow. Now streaming on Paramount Plus. Only with the Paramount Plus with Showtime plan.
Jeremy Renner returns to Paramount Plus for a brand new season of the original hit series, Mayor of Kingstown.
My job is to create a balance, avoid a war.
From executive producer Taylor Sheridan, co-creator of Yellowstone.
There's some new players in town, and they brought the flake.
And Antoine Fuqua, director of Training Day.
I know it's always been a war zone, Mike, but this is next level.
The mayor is back in business.
Are you warning me?
You don't want to find out.
Mayor of Kingstown. New season streaming June 2nd. Exclusively on Paramount Plus.
The chilling new original docuseries on Paramount Plus.
Why did he kill his family? The answer lies across the ocean and a woman named Sylvie.
She's a CAN model.
Where desire leads to deception.
I ended up spending $12,000 and $15,000 a day.
It was addictive.
I can't get you out.
And obsession leads to murder.
Who did this to your family?
You can't really maintain a fantasy forever.
Control Alt Desire, now streaming on Paramount Plus.
Welcome into the Odds and Audibles podcast. Matt Prehm, Eric Scopel on the show today. It's been a long time coming. We've wanted to do a basketball podcast. Obviously, football season played a factor into the delay of it, and then the start of both teams delayed it. But here we are. Both teams in the stretch run of their regular seasons, both playing for different stakes, unexpected stakes for both. They're both not where they want to be. We're going to start with the men here first. It's a program that coming into the year, they were expecting a deep roster going 10, 11 guys deep. They were expecting a team to field a tournament team. And I feel like you watch that first game of the season against what has turned out to be a solid Georgia team. They're not an elite team, but nonetheless a solid team. They absolutely destroyed the Bulldogs in week one or game one of the season. And you saw some glimpses of it. And then you felt like this team was maybe going to be a tournament team. They had the talent, you felt like. And then for the third straight year now, injuries have just decimated the rotation. Three guys that were supposed to be starters at the beginning of the year, Nate Biddle, Jesse Zarzuela, and Keyshawn Bartholomew, are all out for season-ending injuries. Mookie Cook, a freshman, has dealt with an injury that happened before he even got here, and he's only been able to play four or five games and is done for the season. And Fale Dante has only played like 11 games because of injuries. Jackson Shellstead has had injuries. The list goes on and on. Injuries have impacted this team, and unfortunately, it's the third straight year. I think this team would be different if they were healthy, but it's also fans are getting tired of hearing about the injuries and the lack of success and the lack of continuity on the court because of said injuries. And maybe that's fair, maybe that's not fair. We'll discuss some of that, but it's a team that I think had expectations of being in the tournament. They needed to have those expectations, and I don't know yet how to judge this season because it's a weird one. The injuries have certainly impacted it, but at the same time, it's kind of getting to that point where you can't lean on those injuries anymore being not making things okay, but at least walking away saying, like, things are going to be better because they'll be healthy next season. This is the third straight year that this has happened.
Well, right, and you do get to a point where – you know, Dana Altman does have the roster he has, and he's now known for a minute that he's had it. And you know, I think the thing that sort of stands out to me a little bit here is, and those listening know, I suffered a concussion on like January 3rd. It was a couple of days after the Fiesta Bowl. I'd been following the men's team. I actually covered the USC and UCLA home games right before that, and Oregon won both those games. And, you know, I kind of came away feeling really optimistic about where they were because they won those games. They were kind of on a bit of a roll there to start conference play, and they were doing it without Nate Biddle. They were doing it without Nfali Dante, without Mookie Cook. And the kind of the, you know, the discussion at that point was, man, when they get all of these pieces back, they're just going to take off. And man, Jackson Shellstead at that point was playing, I think, at a level where you're going, is this the best true freshman Oregon has had, like, ever, in terms of just the way he was playing? I mean, he was playing at such a high level, and especially playing at that position where he was handling the ball so much. And then you get those guys back, Matt, and you can correct me if you disagree on this, but, you know, then you do get Involle back. And then Nate Biddle does return, and obviously that was very short-lived, and same thing with Mookie Cook, but you kind of start getting these pieces back, and you think, okay, it's going to – not only are they going to go from being a team that was able to beat USC and UCLA kind of shorthanded, where you were playing Kwame Evans Jr. and Muhammad Diawara, like, you know, 30 minutes per player, which was not what the intended plan was going into the season. Well, you're going to get these guys back. But when they get back, they just haven't really taken that stride. In fact, it's kind of gone the other way, Matt. I don't know, like, you can kind of maybe speak more towards it, because I've missed a lot of these games because of the concussion in terms of being able to actually watch it. I've obviously followed and done the box score watching, but what is it that's taken place here when they did start getting some of these players back? Because you do look at the splits for especially like a Shellstead, where he was playing in kind of like a lead guard situation, to now, I know we just had a couple of good games in a row, but it seemed like he kind of hit a wall there, or something kind of was off in terms of what happened once Involle came back.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think they found a way that fit their style of play, and it was let's go real fast. Essentially, they weren't shortening the game, and they were playing basically five out when for most of, you know, five man out, and they didn't really have a post presence. When Mo Diawara was in the game, he was, you know, he was down on the block every once in a while, but they weren't force feeding the ball into the paint, and it forced everyone to be spread out. They were a lot of dribble drive, penetration, kick outs, swings, passes, and it fit kind of the style of play that they had. And I actually had discussions with some people on Press Row a couple times before these guys started coming back, that like maybe Nate Biddle would be the better fit between Biddle and Dante. Just from allowing them to still play that four out or five out type perspective, because Dante's a shooter. But I think, you know, we haven't seen Biddle really return. He played two games, and then he's got this illness that sounds pretty scary, where like he literally can't leave his apartment to even get to school. He's lost a bunch of weight. He doesn't look good. He's trying to get back, but Altman doesn't seem very confident in that happening. But I've kind of flipped back to Dante being the more important piece, because he brings something that no one else brings on the floor for you, and that's a dominant big man. We saw it against Oregon State how they just had no answer for his ability to back people down and score. But you're right, like they haven't gelled like we anticipated they would. But I think the bigger injury here is Jesse Zarzuelas and Keyshawn Bartholomew combined. It's messed the rotations up. And if you notice, like they struggled a little bit with before Bartholomew got hurt. They lost at Colorado, they lost at Utah, they beat Arizona State, and then they lost to Arizona. But the Utah game, they were ultra competitive, and you could have argued they should have won that game, and they just didn't play good. It was Dante's second game back, I think Biddle's second game back as well, or third, maybe Biddle came back against ASU. They were still kind of getting Dante into the mix. And I think if they had played that game today, they probably win that game, just because Dante's more in shape than he was a month ago, 6 weeks ago. But the Bartholomew and the Zarzuela injury has basically forced Shellstead to have to play 30, 35, sometimes even 40 minutes a game. And what we didn't see the first five games of conference play, which we should note, like, USC is terrible. When we didn't know that at the time,
right? Talented roster.
Yeah, we thought they were going to be good. They had injuries too, and their roster is drastically different now. UCLA was still figuring their things out, and we should know that. Like, even though they're fourth in the conference, they're 14-12. Like, they're a competitive team, but they're not a good team. And then Washington is bad. Washington State's improved. Obviously, they're second in the conference. They're good.
That's probably their best win of the season, right, Matt?
That yes, 100%. Up in Pullman is their best win of the season. And then California came to town, and they're improved, but they're not good. So I think maybe the schedule that they played to start the year kind of inflated things. And Dana was like, I tried to get Dana a couple times to be positive about the 5-0 start, and he never did it. And I kind of wondered, hindsight, like if he kind of knew, like, hey, this was going to be an easy stretch. We should have been 5-0, you know, at this point, or 4-1, and he wasn't going to, you know, boast too much about it. But I think the Bartholomew, what's happened is the scouting report on Shelstead is out. He's not a good defender. And if you look at Colorado, you look at the Utah game, you look at Arizona, and then you look at UCLA and Washington State as well, teams are attacking him. And because they don't have Bartholomew and they don't have Zarzuela, they really can't take him off the floor to help that. And what this impacts even more now is your other options are, okay, do we put Brennan Rigsby at point guard, which they've done a little bit, but he's nowhere near the ball handler. He's nowhere near the creator. And he also is struggling defensively. He's no better than what Jackson Shelstead is. And then he's in a shooting slump. Just, you know, Shelstead's kind of getting out of his, but Rigsby hasn't shot it well the last couple of weeks. Or your other option is you put Jermaine Cousinard at point guard, or you ask Jermaine Cousinard to guard the team's top player, and he can do that, and he's a good defender, but it makes life more harder for him on both ends of the floor, because now you're asking him to be your go-to scorer and you're asking him to be your lockdown defender. That's hurting just the overall play of him. Jadrian Tracy, it's the same thing. I think we've finally hit the point where they've reached a certain number of injuries at a certain position where it's now making life difficult. Not because they don't have talent, but they just don't have enough of it. They don't. When a guy has an off night, they don't have another option to help alleviate that struggle. And Shelstead's a tremendous offensive player, but he's not good defensively. And we've seen, go look at the box scores over, you know, since Colorado. KJ Simpson absolutely cooked Jackson Shelstead. Davion Smith from Utah did the same thing. Caleb Love, while Shelstead didn't guard him, was unstoppable for Arizona, and Oregon just didn't have enough defenders to throw at him. Different guys to try defending him. Washington State, Miles Rice in the second half just lit up Jackson Shelstead. Now, Shelstead, we should note, was on Jordan Pope for Oregon State most recently for most of the game. And Pope is one of the league's top scorers, and he did not have a good night. So Shelstead has shown the ability to defend, but I, the defensive issues and the lack of depth and lack of options to replace guys who aren't playing well defensively is a big issue. And then they're playing a different style from what they were really good at. And it's a kind of a chicken or the egg deal, because Dante's your best player. He's the guy that few teams in the league have to stop. And yet I don't think he fits what makes everyone else around him play at their best. That's a very difficult water to maneuver.
I was saying this to somebody recently, I can't remember who, but it reminds me, and it's not the exact same thing, but faintly of the Bull year of when, and kind of inverted here, because Bull was healthy for the first part, and then the team found its footing playing kind of a smaller style in the back half, and I think reached the Sweet 16 that year. This season, the team kind of reached kind of an interesting stylistic, I think, playing a way that Dana likes to play in early January, and then Infali comes back. And I don't want to say at all that the team is better off without him, because to your point, he's a very, very good player. But I also think there is something to your point earlier of, like, if Nate Biddle or just a player who fits that kind of like archetype of a player were in this lineup as the five, I think they would probably be off to be in a little better spacing situation, at least in terms of, because they do have to get the ball down to Enfali. And to your point, teams are going to double team him because he's really, really good. If you single him, there's not a lot of guys in this conference that are going to be able to defend him. And I think he struggles a little bit at times with that double, and it should lead to a little bit more easy offense than it does. So it's a weird one because, to your point, I think he is probably your most gifted player on the roster, but I don't know if the team has been playing its best since he's returned, Matt, and I don't know exactly what to say about that.
They've not figured out how to play together. And Dana's talked about this a ton where everyone, they throw the ball into Dante, and he said, and everyone else just kind of stops moving and just expects Dante to dominate and to, you know, to do whatever he needs to do and score. And that's not what's going to be conducive to a good offense. Everyone's got to move around, even though Dante's got the ball. He's also pointed out that, like, they've spent all offseason preparing for an offense built around Biddle and Dante together down on the post, inside out. And then both guys really quickly got hurt out for an extended period of time. And they had to completely change the offense. And then midway through the season, throw Dante back in, but without Biddle, and now build an entirely third stylistic way of playing. And so, like, these sound like excuses, but I think it explains why this team is maybe so rigid still late in February. Why historically Dan Altman teams continue to get better and better and better as the season goes on. And this team hasn't shown that because they've literally had to change the way they've played now three times. And it's musical chairs. Every month you don't know who's going to be available. And it's hard collectively as a group to get better. Like, I think Jadrian Tracy has improved individually from where he was at the start of the season to where he is today. I think you can say the same thing about Dante. I think you can say that about Jermaine Cousinard. I think a couple guys have maybe are in slumps a little bit. Like, Rigsby and Shelstead were playing at such a high level earlier in the year than they are now. Shelstead's starting to get back. Rigsby is not. I think if you just look at the pure numbers standpoint, they've done an unbelievable job developing Cario Aquindo into a three-point shooter, a guy that shot 28% the previous year. And when he was added, I remember on DuckTerritory.com, on Twitter, and on this show, a lot of people were upset at his addition. Why are they adding a non-shooter to the team? He's shooting a team-high 41% on threes. He has made improvements, and he's averaging 9 points in 17 minutes a game. His defense certainly needs a lot of work. But you see guys individually getting better, but collectively they haven't gotten better as a unit like we've historically seen, just because it's been musical chairs. And it sounds like an excuse. It is one, but at the same time, like we said at the beginning of the year, this is the third year of this happening. And that being a factor or being a reason why things aren't progressing, people don't want to hear it anymore. And it sounds harsh. And, you know, Altman understands it too. He's even said it, like, we get it. This is the third year in a row. It sucks. You know, it's the hand we've been dealt, but it's not the hand that we wanted.
Yeah. And to the point of Altman teams typically finding their footing in February and March, that's usually with them having played for 3 months together. And to your point, Matt, this team's basically played with three different iterations of itself, and you're now in about week five of this team. So, like, maybe by the time they get to conference tournament play, that's when you see it, you know, the light come on, so to speak. And maybe they're able to win that and make a run in the NCAA tournaments, and everybody kind of turns around and forgets that. But of course, that is absolute best case scenario here, because the margin for error to miss the tournament is very, very, very small. And, you know, this speaks to the unfortunate part where in non-conference play, they didn't really have a lot of marquee wins. It wasn't a tough schedule. And the games that would have really helped them, some of them I lost because they were just really banged up. So they are in a pretty precarious situation, Matt. I know you wanted to do a little bit just on kind of what is in front of them, and also a little bit on kind of where you think things are with Dana. because I know there's been, I mean, I hate to say it, the two most popular threads on our message board for about a week and a half have been fire Dana Altman and fire Kelly Graves. And there have been a lot of back and forth amongst the fan base. So I don't know what you'd rather do first, Matt, in terms of looking at the short term or looking at the big picture with Dana. But I know those are two things to discuss.
I think let's go big picture first. I don't think you can't be realistic without saying the seat is getting warmer. The pressure to win is getting bigger. I don't think Oregon should, and I don't think they will move on from Dana Altman after this season. I don't think Dana Altman will move on from Oregon after this season. So I think they're together next year. But what I do think is fair and a reasonable expectation is that this is kind of the last year that when you sit down for your exit interview as a player, or when you sit down with your internal review as a coaching staff, or when the staff, if they do, I would assume they do, meet with Rob Mullins at the end of the year to kind of just debrief the year and air, you know, all their grievances and their positives and all that. I think this is the last year that that this group can come out and say, like, if it wasn't for injuries, we would have been a tournament team. Like moving forward, if injuries hit hard, you know, tough luck. Like, you've had 3 years of experience trying to maneuver it. You've got to figure it out. And the one caveat I will say, though, is that they have – it's very clear. Everyone knows it. They've been decimated by injuries. And yet they can only worry about themselves. They can't worry about the strength of the rest of the league. They can only worry about themselves. And so even though I understand the league hasn't been this elite league the last couple of seasons, they still have managed every single year over the, you know, this year they're at 9-5 in conference play. They're 3 wins away from 20 wins in the regular season. And we should note that whenever Dana Altman has won 20 games in the regular season since 2012, 2013, they've made the NCAA tournament. So that's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. That's 7 times when they've won 20 games in the regular season. Every year they've made the tournament. They're 3 games away from winning 20 in the regular season. I'm not going to say that's a guarantee that they make the tournament. And not only that, they've, even through these injuries, last 3 seasons, this year, last year, and the year before, they have been in contention towards at the very end of the last week of the season for a top 4 spot in the conference play and in the Pac-12 tournament. They're competitive. They had a path towards the very end of the year of trying to get a share of the league championship. This season, they're technically not out of it. And while I don't think it's going to happen, the path to a league title is very, very possible. Like, they still have to play at Arizona.
Right.
Arizona still has to play Washington State this week. Those are the 2 teams ahead of you. There's a real possibility that, you know, Oregon could find themselves into a tie for first place in the conference. And so I say all that knowing, like, think about how bad the injuries have been. And yet every year, this team has been able to at least stay competitive within its own league. The conference record hasn't bottomed out. Ohio State recently fired their head coach, Chris Holtman. And, fans are going to point, well, it's because it's 2 years of not making the NCAA tournament and they're trending on a third year. And that certainly is a part of it. But if you look at his record in conference play, they bottomed out. They've got 9 wins in the last 2 seasons in Big Ten play. And it's a tougher league. It is. You have to acknowledge that.
Yep.
But they aren't competitive in their own league anymore. That's why they fired Chris Holtman. Not because they weren't making the tournament. That's a factor. But the bigger issue is if you're not competitive in your own league, you're not even close to being in discussion of the tournament. And Oregon's being competitive. So I don't think they should. I don't think they will. I think next season becomes a really big year for Dana Altman. If they don't make it for a 4th straight year, then changes get discussed. And I don't think that change includes his job status, but you have to fully evaluate what's going on here. Maybe you're you know, it probably opens the door for someone having to move on from the program. I don't think it would be Altman. I have a hard time firing the school's all-time leader in wins and tournament appearances and all of that, as long as he's being competitive. Now, if next season shows up and something similar happens to Ohio State where they aren't competitive at all in Big Ten play and they win two or three games, then yeah, probably have to really think about the longevity of the program. I don't think that will happen though. So it's probably not what some fans want to hear. I think Altman is pretty safe right now. Recruiting hasn't fallen off. Transfer portal interest hasn't fallen off. They've just been second to two of the most important transfers the last couple of years, and it's unfortunate they didn't get them. Dalton Kinect being at Tennessee, Antonio Reeves being at Kentucky. They were second for both those guys. Like, so talent identification isn't an issue from a portal perspective. It's just finishing the deal. They thought they had Kinect. They thought they had Reeves, and then two other programs swooped in and took them. So I don't think recruiting is an issue. I don't think transfer portal is an issue. I think also for the first time in a long time, you have roster stability. There will be transfers. There will be guys that leave this team after this season. But between Biddle, between Shelstead, between Tracy, between Kwame Evans, Kari Okendo, Keyshawn Bartholomew, Brennan Rigsby, I think a good group of those guys, Mookie Cook, those guys, if you can get 75% of that group back next season, Shelstead being the most important guy, and I don't see any reason why he would leave.
Right.
Get those, you know, 75% of those guys, Kwame Evans back, like plus what you have coming in. You add one or two portal guys. The talent level is as good, if not better, than it was this season. And things are progressing up, and you're trending up. Now you have roster continuity. I think if you move on from Dana Altman, you lose everybody, basically.
Probably.
And now you go into a new conference that's even better with a completely gutted roster. What Washington, what every Duck fan is making fun of Washington football for, that would happen for men's basketball, going into a tougher league without a head coach, without your best young players, and you probably lose your recruiting class as well. So I don't think it's beneficial to move off at all. And I don't think it should be anyways.
You can now relive the best moments of the UEFA Champions League 24/7. The UEFA Champions League channel is a new 24-hour streaming channel serving non-stop goals, highlights, and full match replays from the world's most prestigious club competition. Reminisce on your favorite moments, legendary players, and brilliant goals with the UEFA Champions League channel streaming around the clock on Pluto TV and the CBS Sports app.
On May 23rd,
I want to go back to normal. What's normal?
The Paramount Plus original series, Evil Returns.
We've already hunted werewolves and demons.
And now what? A baby antichrist?
Okie dokie.
Prepare yourself.
You will not beat us.
For the end.
I have visions of hell.
Make it stop. Make it shut up.
You're not gonna survive this.
Evil, the final season. Streaming May 23rd, only on Paramount Plus. This is Tony Kornheiser's show. I'm Tony. You expected someone else? So what exactly is the show about? I don't know. It's a sports show nominally. Football's over, but we're finally at a point where things matter in college basketball, and baseball season is on deck. Greatest three words in the English language, pitchers and catchers. We have some of the best voices come on and explain what matters or what makes an upset, like Ryan does, 9-8. No, that's not an upset. No, yeah, it is, Bob. And if you're lucky, I might just tell you about my search for discounted sleep pants or my worries about what my dog just ate. Listen on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Do we want to talk about the women now, where these conversations are very different?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean,
and just to be clear, man, I mean, it's not my beat. I'm obviously not as following quite as closely, and the concussions really got in the way. I was really enjoying watching this team, but I have a hard time moving on from Altman for a lot of the reasons you said, and also just because I think in general we're way too quick to want to fire people. I mean, like, you know, like Tosh Lupoi, we had message board threads suggesting he'd be fired after his first year as defensive coordinator at Oregon. That's kind of crazy to me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm not saying that everything was perfect, but look what a little patience, look what it did, right? This last year's defense was much improved. And I understand a lot of people listening will just say, well, you know, Dan deserves credit for that. But I think Tosh deserves some credit. Like, he's pretty invested. You talk to the players, they respect, and you talk to coaches around the program, they respect and think Tosh does a good job. But the reality is, like, this is the way it works. Is people want to talk about people being fired. So I don't know if I want to jump right into the Kelly Graves, should he be fired apart or not, but
real quick. You talk about we want to move off from coaches, you know, so quickly. Like, this is really the first, like, multi-year stretch that Altman has had at Oregon over his 14 years where it's been a struggle. Mm-hmm. And what we're describing as a struggle is a team that's still winning over 500% of its games in conference play. Like, he's only had 1 year where they haven't finished above 500 in conference play. And that was his first season when they went 7-11 in conference play. You go back the last 30 years, including Altman's time here at Oregon, and they have 1, 2, 3, 4. They have 5 seasons where he's only, you know, where the program has had a winning record in conference play. This isn't UCLA. This isn't Arizona. This isn't Ohio State, even from a past success history. They're still in a stretch where it's the best it's ever been consistently year in and year out. And you want to move on from that because they've had two seasons, really. We don't know what happens this year.
Right.
Two seasons where it's not been its best. What you said, people want to move off so quickly. And I just wanted to point that out. Like, maybe you find something better, but historically at Oregon, it's been a lot worse. It doesn't mean you can't demand improvement. You can't demand excellence at Oregon, because you should, but just some perspective.
No, it's a good perspective. The women's conversation is very different, I think. Now, the context of past success between Graves and Altman is very similar. These are the two best basketball coaches that have coached these programs. It's not really close. There's not really room to debate. And I know people on the message boards get fired up now when they're discussing someone should be fired, and suddenly Kelly Graves' career resume gets denigrated and all past success with somebody else's, you know, because of what somebody else did, and all failures currently are his fault, and that's the way it goes. But that is kind of where the similarities kind of end for me between the men's and women's programs, is that these are undoubtedly the most successful coaches that have been here. These are coaches that have reached heights that hadn't been previously reached. I mean, the women's team had, I think, 5 NCAA tournament wins before Kelly Graves got here. He's won 12 games in the NCAA tournament, and almost all of those took place with Sabrina here. And that doesn't even include one tournament where I think a lot of people think they probably would have won the national championship. I know a lot of people at Oregon who were diehard fans at the time felt that way. I know a lot of people nationally felt that way. But what has happened since Sabrina has left has been disappointed by, I think, anybody's standards. I don't think even Kelly Graves would come out here and say it's gone great, because you think about the trajectory the program was on, and I'm doing more of a big picture as opposed to the single year thing, but we can get to that in a second. But, you know, they land the number one recruiting class in the country. We call it the Fab Five in 2020, the year after Sabrina. None of those players last more than 3 years. This was supposed to be that group's final run, right? Like, if everything had worked out and they'd all stayed together, this would have been senior seasons for that class. And this is where everything would be coming into kind of focus of this is the buildup. And instead, none of those players are on the roster. The talent is very much outmatched every game in Pac-12 play. and they've lost 9 straight games. It's the most in 30 years. They're last place in the Pac-12. It's 2 consecutive years where they've lost at least 7 games in a row. Last year, they had kind of their own February to March swoon where they just dropped a bunch of games. And last year, by the way, they almost made the NCAA tournament anyway. Like they had, I think, the net rating in the 20s. They were one of the last 4 teams out, regardless of that. But this year's season has been very different. And, you know, kind of my piece and what I really wanted to say on this is, I'm not a guy who comes out and says it's time to fire anybody. And I'm not going to say on this podcast it's time to fire Kelly Graves. I don't feel like that is probably my place to do that. I will say, having watched the last 2 games and just kind of the slump they're in, it's probably the first time I've understood fan frustration and felt like there's a lot of points that you can argue in that favor, right? Like, because there were people saying he should have been fired after last year, and you're kind of going like, well, if you look at the history of the program, this is the most successful coach ever. At least they made the WNIT. I know it's not a step forward, but maybe let's give him some time to figure it out. It's a tenuous situation here, and I do think, unlike Dana Altman, because you made the case for Chris Holtmann and the Big Ten for why that made sense. Well, Oregon women's basketball is not competitive in the Pac-12 right now. They're in last place, and the thing that's been startling for me, and again, I was with a concussion. I missed most of the games in January and into early February because of it, you know, but just kind of looking at the box scores and how things have come together, I think there's a really important stretch just to convey how uncompetitive they've become. The first 3 times they played Colorado, they played Utah, and they played who's the 3rd team I had on this list here? I'm trying to remember who it was. USC. The first time they played those 3 teams earlier in conference play in January, they lost by a combined 37 points. Nothing to write home about. Don't be thrilled about it. 12-point per game margin. But that's at least like you're kind of in a game if it's a 12-point game. Like you're at least in contact. Maybe other folks don't think that way and they think those are blowouts. I don't, because having watched or followed through some of those games, it did seem like those were entirely blowouts every single time. They then play those three teams these last couple weekends here, and the margin has ballooned to like 93 points in those games. So you go from losing by like 12 points to 30 points to the same teams in the course of a month. I know these are really, really good teams, and the schedule, we should note, this 9-game winning losing streak, 8 are against top 20 teams. That's a scheduling. That's a really tough stretch of schedule.
Murderous row.
It's probably one of the toughest stretches that I've seen in covering sports, just because you don't usually see it stacked on top of each other like this. And in the Pac-12 in women's basketball, unlike men's basketball, is a really, really, really tough conference. And there are 6 teams that legitimately can play their way into the Sweet 16, and no one would be surprised. They're ranked in that kind of range.
Since January 5th, they've played 7 top 10 teams.
Yeah, it's been a really tough schedule, and they've lost every single one of them. But my point has been, and I think what stands out from just this past weekend, of they aren't competitive in these games. Again, this was my reintroduction to watching these games, and the game against USC was over after about 5 minutes. USC got up 13-2. The game was pretty much over. Actually, 19-2 eventually, but like it was pretty much, it just kind of, oh, this one's not going to go their way. Same thing happened against UCLA on Sunday. I know that game ended up being 19 as opposed to 38, but you know, this is a team that is not competitive. And we can talk about roster flaws. We can talk about injuries, because there have been some significant injuries. Peyton Scott.
I wanted to bring that up.
Yeah.
Because I do think it's very interesting that the injury play gets brought up all the time for the men. And
yep.
While I think this season the excuses are starting to – or the fan base is starting to become tired of it.
Right.
Being a reason why. But I think generally most Oregon men's fans, the men's basketball program's fan base, they generally accept the fact that, yes, without these guys, you know, we have to take a step back in what we can do because of injuries. Like, that's natural. That happens.
Sure.
The women, it doesn't seem to get brought up nearly as much as a factor for this season. You know the team way more than I do.
Yeah.
But from my understanding, they lost Peyton Scott at the beginning of the year.
5 minutes into the season. She played 5 minutes.
She's supposed to be your point guard. And we know under Kelly Graves' program, if he doesn't have a point guard, things get real hard. And if you have a good point guard, like we've seen, they're competitive. And they are a good team. And then, to my understanding, Sophia Bell, who's now out for the year, was kind of your high potential, maybe best wing defender.
Definitely the best wing defender, without question. Yeah, she was their best defensive player. She held Juju Watkins to like her lowest scoring game of the season. That's that USC freshman who scored 33 up here.
Right. So you have two players, your best defender, which it's clearly you're struggling to defend, and it's clear your offense. I mean, the games that I've watched, I see Grace Van Sluten bring the ball up way more than I've ever seen, and yeah. I think that's part of her skill set, but I also think that's part of because there's a lack of a point guard on the team. And these two injuries don't get brought up, I don't think, nearly enough as would they be a top 10 team with these two players? I'm not naive to think that. But maybe it factors into losses earlier in the year where they lost to Portland at home, by 29 or whatever it was. They lost to I think Utah Tech in Utah, like right around
The really ugly one, Matt, was Santa Clara at home, I think by 39. Yes. That was the one where you're going, ugh.
Like, would those losses have happened if some of these injuries didn't play? Now, Sophia Bell recently got hurt.
Yeah.
And I would say recently, meaning the last month. But the Peyton Scott one, like, would she have turned around some of these outcomes or at least – turned games like you mentioned where you're not even competitive? Maybe they are competitive with these players, and that doesn't get brought up enough. And I think that has to be factored into some of this discussion of job security, if we will, or program assessment, just because two key pieces aren't available and they have a short bench already. And that could, you know, that falls on Kelly for not having a full bench, but
this is a team that has very little reliable talent. They basically have three players that score on their entire team. Like, if you go look through it without Bell now, I think their fourth leading scorer averages less than 4 points per game. You know, it's basically been Grace Van Sluten, Chance Gray, and Filipina Che. And I think quietly, Filipina Che's had a really great season and has really improved. I mean, I think if there's a player on that program to point to who's really taking strides, it would be Filipina Che, who's improved as a scorer, who's improved her free throw percentages, who's, I think, become even better rebounder and rim defender. Doesn't always show up. I think against UCLA on Sunday against Lauren Betts, who's her size and just a better player flat out. This is the former number one recruit in the country. She got handled pretty well. Betts clearly won that matchup. I don't think it was really close, but I think that's encouraging. But you see strides for one player, and you still look up and go, there's not – I mean, the reality is right now, and I hate to say this, is that they're starting – a shooting guard who was prior to this year wasn't even playing basketball. She was focusing on her modeling career, you know, and the year, and before that she'd been at UC Davis and, you know, at some other smaller schools. So I'm not sure it was UC Davis. It might be UC San Diego. I think I got that wrong. But regardless, Ula Chamberlain is not somebody you're expecting going into the year to be playing a lot. And now she's starting. And that sort of speaks to the depth stuff. But, you know, I think more broadly, this was a team that was picked eighth in the Pac-12 to start. I don't think anybody had really high expectations. I don't think you're wrong at all in terms of the injury parts impacting, especially Peyton Scott. Like losing a point guard, I think even the most, you know, anti-Kelly Graves folks out there, his biggest detractors would say, that's a tough way to start a season. You lose your
5 minutes into the year.
5 minutes into the season, a fifth-year senior who scored over 1,000 points in her career at Miami of Ohio. She's lost for the whole rest of the way. Like, that's just that's tough. But regardless, this wasn't a team that was going to reach the highest of ceilings. And I thought, like, at best, it was going to be seventh to eighth, maybe. Like, if everything fell together. And it hasn't come together that way, in part because they're just not as good as a lot of these teams. And that's the point that Kelly Graves continues to make. And I did want to spend a second here because I know we want to wrap up. I don't think people want to hear us talk about women's basketball for an hour based upon previous podcast discussions or the comments in the sections. But you know, I do think it was really notable, the back and forth between Kelly Graves and James Crepia from the Oregonian on Sunday after the UCLA loss. 9 straight losses, another game where they lose by 20. It really wasn't competitive. They got it down to 12-13 in the third quarter and kind of had a moment there where if they could have just strung together some baskets. UCLA didn't score its third basket of the second half until about 3 minutes to play in the third quarter. And Oregon had a chance to make a run. They didn't. Regardless, it wasn't a competitive game. And for the first time in Kelly Graves' career, and certainly the first time this year, he was kind of pressed about his job security. And he doesn't seem to be all that concerned. And I think that's correct, which is going to bum out some fans listening to this who want him to be fired. Again, I brought it up earlier. The two most popular threads on our message board was a fire Kelly Graves and a fire Dana Altman thread. Notably, the fire Kelly Graves thread had like no downvotes. Like everybody was kind of like, I guess. And the fire Dana Altman thread had like 80 downvotes. Like I think a lot of people, I think just consensus on our message board, people are much more agreeable that Kelly Graves deserves to be done at Oregon and they need to make a change. I don't anticipate that happens. He's under contract through the end of the decade with, at least in the women's space, a pretty lucrative deal. They'd have to pay about $6 million for him not to coach here, which would be something they could certainly stomach if they really wanted to, if they thought it got to that point. I don't know if that is where Rob Mullins is. I've had a hard time kind of getting a lot of people to talk about this, as you'd understand. But my sense is that it's not probable that he gets fired. I do think it for the first time, I've kind of gotten to the point where I go, it does feel like it's going to take everything falling into place for this to turn around, for the ship to really be righted to a place where they can get back to contending for top half of conferences, to making NCAA tournaments, because the roster is so beaten down right now. And unlike the men, and this will be my last point, I think unlike the men, the women have really suffered from an inability to retain players.
Yeah.
And it's not really been a recruiting problem.
It's retention. You know?
It's been a retention problem.
That could be NIL. That could be coaching staff issues.
That could be coaching staff issues. That could be a lot of things. Like I know one or two of the players that have left on totally great terms. They left because they didn't have playing time opportunities and they went other places. And I shouldn't say opportunities, but they didn't love their playing time situations and they went to other schools, were given more opportunity, and they blossomed. But I think the thing that makes this most glaring is when you're a fan of a team and you see all these big time players brought in, and Oregon had brought in probably like close to double digit 5-star recruits post Sabrina. Like it was an incredible amount of success on the recruiting trail, but when basically none of them stick it out for 4 years, that, and I think there's plenty of reasonable explanations for pretty much all of them from everything I've heard. I don't think there's like this massive underlying thing. But even if there isn't, it becomes a problem. And because my point is, you could build a top 25 roster off of transfers from Oregon, like of players that are playing at other schools in the country right now that aren't at Oregon. That would, if they were to compose this all-star transfer team and they were to roll into Matthew Knight Arena, they'd probably beat Oregon by about what USC just beat Oregon by. So that's the part I think that really bothers fans, is you're looking up on the roster and you're going, okay, this team's not very good, but if we had just been able to hold on to 50% of the good players that left, we wouldn't have this talent gap, which is currently the issue. And even if there are reasonable explanations for it, the coach is going to be the one charged with roster retention problems. So
it's, I'm glad you brought that up, because like inverted, I watch games here and there for the women because I'm so focused on the men's team. Mm-hmm. But I have caught games, and my overall interest just has gone down just because of what exactly you said. Of, you look at the players that have left, whether it's Rogers or Pow Pow or Jess Shelley.
They just played Angela Dugalich this last weekend at UCLA, who's a very good player.
You see the players leave, and I think what for me, as a call me like the average fan. What would cause me for concern and what would be a concern for the program is you see familiar names leave to go to better or equal footing schools and have better careers than they are having at Oregon. And that is a concern of, and I don't think that also means you have to just cut bait with everyone that's associated with running the program and start over. But that's, I think, probably the charge this off season, because like you, I've gone back and forth on this. I probably lean right now, like this staff deserves the opportunity to dig themselves out of this hole, to build the ladder and climb out of the hole that they're in. And I think that they could do it because you look at the history of the program and Kelly Graves has been a winner ever since basically year three. And the program has been elite except for the last two seasons. And even like you said, last year, they almost darn made the tournament with a 7-11 record in conference play. Yeah. But you have to, I think that the charge this offseason is they've got to do a full assessment internally of just like the men do of, are we in a competitive space in the NIL factor here? And if we're not, we need to fix that because a school like Oregon, that's unacceptable. And I don't think that's all on Kelly Graves. I don't think that's all on Dana Altman. I think there is a genuine commitment from the school from being competitive in the NIL space. But I also think Oregon's arm, Division Street, is understandably heavily focused on football than it is on other sports. And if you want to be competitive in these sports beyond football, you still have to compete and be at, you know, you have to be at a competitive level, you know, NIL factor-wise for basketball and other sports. We know both teams, they have seen players leave because they had better NIL options.
I know that for a fact.
It's happened for both players, for both programs. And the players that have left probably shouldn't have left, but they left because they had better NIL offers and Oregon couldn't afford it. That's, to me, that's not on the head coach. That's the NIL arm, and that's unacceptable for what the Oregon brand presents itself to be. But I think the coaching staff for the women, they have to figure out why are we no longer competitive? What are we doing that we were doing previously? How can we improve? How can we – roster retainment is the biggest thing for me. Just like what happened with Altman during the middle stretch of his career at Oregon – The women's program has kind of become unrecognizable.
Oh, yeah.
To the average fan that previously you knew, like, hey, like these four players, five players, they may all not start, but they're all key players. They're all going to be back next season. They were all back from last year. That is no longer the case for this team. I actually had a question for you. Like,
hit me with it.
This is a multi-year fix, but the positive thing for basketball, unlike football, is you can quickly turn around a roster.
Sure.
Like you can flip it entirely. And if Chance Gray and Van Sluten and Filipina Che come back, Sophia Bell gets healthy and is back. That's four players that you feel like, hey, you've got four athletes that can be competitive. Peyton Scott, is she projecting to come back or?
Graves has said she's softly committed to planning on returning. She has eligibility.
So let's just lump her in the mix. Now you've got five. You've got a starting five that you feel like you can at least be competitive with. And look, you're going to a conference that's not going to be as good as the Pac-12. That has to be acknowledged as well. Like the road will get a little easier next season. With those five being your core, do they have enough pieces coming in? I know they've got two really talented freshmen, a point guard and a post player from Germany or overseas, one of the two. I can't.
Luxembourg Barkley, as I've heard her nickname. She's from Luxembourg.
With that seven, it's like do you feel the confidence that they can go out and they can add two or three portal players? Or is this something that, hey, even with these additions – and some roster retainment, the confidence that 2024-25 they're going to get back to being a top 25 team, is that too unrealistic to think that as a possibility?
It's a good question, Matt, and it's hard to sometimes project this because sometimes the bare bones of a good team don't look like the bare bones of a good team.
Sure.
What Oregon has put out recently in terms of the talent looks terrible, like comparative to the other teams. But, you know, the fact that I do think they have kind of three good players. I do think Chance Gray, Grace Van Slipen, and Philip Pinochet are all good players and starting caliber players. I think two of them are being completely miscast. And I think some of that, you know, is Kelly related. Some of that is injury related, but like Chance Gray should be playing off ball. Like, I think that's where she's best, is being a high end perimeter shooter who can be a secondary ball handler, who can be a creator. But she's been asked to play point guard all year. And Grace Van Slooten, and this was the talk coming into the season, I think perplexed fans even then, has wanted to play more on the perimeter to help her WNBA draft stock. And that experiment has not gone very well with them playing three humongous players. I mean, they're basically going out there and playing, you know, if you want to use, you know, the men's equivalent in height, basically a couple of 7-footers and like a 6'10 player at small forward. That's like kind of what they're playing right now. That's just a really big team. And it's especially problematic when they're so slow up front, and, you know, neither of the bigger players, being Che or Basham, are particularly light of foot or able to really defend multiple positions, are kind of limited to somebody in front of them and just being large and taking up space. So I say that because I think if you were to say the lineup next year was, and again, we'll see what happens with Graves. I think he'll be back, but if we're just talking big picture, the key is to retain those players, Matt. You're right. There's like 4, maybe 5 players that you need to retain if you're actually going to try to right this ship, and it's the players you brought up. But if you could have a lineup where Van Slooten was actually playing the 4, which is her natural position, Che's at the 5, Chance Gray's at the 2, Sophia Bell's at the 3 where she belongs, and Peyton Scott's at point, which again, this was the starting 5 to begin the season. This is what the plan was. If you could actually put that into place, that roster would make some sense and could be decent against a lot of the teams in the Big Ten, in my opinion. But the problem is you'd have to hit the portal really hard, I think. And you really need to gut this bench. Like, there's not a player out of the players we mentioned who is a must keep otherwise. So do I think that's the bare bones of a top 25 roster? No, I don't. Do I think it's a team that could win 16, 17 games next year? Possibly, if everything else falls right. But I do think this is probably not a one-year rebuild where they're suddenly, hey, we're shooting high again. We're back and soaring with the top teams. I think this is a situation where, unfortunately, regardless of who the coach is, because I think if somebody else comes in, they're going to have a hard time too with what's currently on the roster. And I know maybe they'll have great portal connections and they'll be able to build a great team. I think for Oregon women's basketball fans, like I would be surprised if 24-25 is a particularly great season, almost regardless of who the coach is. I might be totally wrong. Things might fall into place and some of these players develop. That's the thing we don't always talk about, is players do get better. And for Gray and Van Slooten and Che, you're all pretty inexperienced players. Like, not a lot of college experience from those players. They're getting those reps in. Maybe they all take big steps this offseason. They're all representing their national teams this year. So maybe there's an opportunity to develop more there, but it's going to take a lot for this to look the way people want it to. And I hope that there's patience in the long term, but I know there won't be, because right now everybody wants the staff to be fired and for everything to start over, but we'll see what happens. This has been very discouraging is where I'll leave it, you know, cause I know we just spent a little bit of time trying to build up what would happen if Kelly returned and maybe they could turn it around. They have issues, and I want to be optimistic, but you know, it's hard for me to get there because I think one of the core parts of our projections for next year is everybody's retained. And I've actually heard the team camaraderie has been great and that the team chemistry is good, and that there does feel like a long-term commitment, but the track record has been Oregon loses 2, maybe 3 starters basically every offseason. And if that's the case this offseason, Kelly's not going to have a lot to stand upon. And I say that as somebody who has supported him since my time at Gonzaga. I have a lot of respect for the way he's run his program. I do think he is the most successful women's basketball coach here by a long shot. And when he was defending himself, talking about the history, like, he has the right to say those things because of what he's accomplished here. I also think it's really hard to sit up here and put on a positive spin of like, I think it's going to be really good in the short term and in the long term, because they've reached a real impasse here where the roster is just not good enough. And you're not getting, to me, from my perspective, the in-game coaching and kind of roster decisions, like lineup wise, it hasn't necessarily been super encouraging either. So I wish there was more positive news to share there. And again, I don't anticipate that there's a coaching change made, just to make that point clear. And I'm not saying it couldn't happen. It could, but I would be surprised.
I will end it here just real quick. I just want to make one comment. You can respond if you disagree or not, but I don't think it's good practice by the school to make a conference change and a head coach change at the same time. You're navigating waters you've never navigated before with a new head coach. This is for both the men and the women, quite frankly. I would much rather get your program kind of settled into the rigors of the new conference and then make a change than deal with the ugly and a new conference. Because the worst thing that could happen is you go to the Big Ten with a new head coach, whether men or women, the roster is completely gutted. Excuse me. The roster is completely gutted, and all of a sudden the program dips even further from where they're at. And then the narrative becomes they're not good enough for this league, when you kind of set yourself up to already fail because of the roster getting gutted by a coaching change. That concerns me. So I personally, I would keep both just to go into the Big Ten and usher in things and then reassess a year or two after.
We'll see. I don't have a real strong opinion that way, Matt, because I could also be convinced like, hey, maybe going into the Big Ten with a new leadership.
Right. New hope.
Yeah, turn over a new leaf and start it that way. Like if you were Rob Mullins and you were to make that decision and that was kind of your message to the fan base, I would be understanding of that as well. But I don't also disagree at all with what you're saying there. I think you could do it either way. And frankly, I think Kelly's going to get another year. And it's going to be a really imperative thing that he takes a hard look at the mirror and figures out a way to retain players, and also probably has to make some staff changes. And that's another thing we haven't really talked about, but it's a very young staff. Like, you know, you look at who's been with him for a long time. A lot of the key assistants, and I know one of their names is Mark Campbell, is a TCU's current head coach, who's kind of had a really rough run because of some injury stuff, but like that's another part of this, is that it's a young assistant coaching staff. A lot of the coaches he had kind of cut his teeth with and worked with at Gonzaga or at Oregon are no longer with him. And I do think that has played somewhat of a role. So I would be curious to see if they reassess some of the assistant coaching decisions there, if they do make changes.
We'll probably discuss more with both programs here and I'm not going to say the immediate future, but here in the next couple of weeks to a month, once kind of each, I don't think we need to do a recap of the women's season right when things are over. Maybe we let the dust settle for a week and then dive into the women. The men will dictate what happens for them. But we're definitely going to need to circle back. What the timing of this will be decided later, but we're going to circle back mm-hmm. on both programs towards the end of the season or shortly after the end of the year and kind of reassess. And I anticipate, look, the portal opens in less than a month for both the men and the women's programs. I anticipate we're going to have a very clear-cut idea of what the rosters will look like shortly after that portal opens. And just like football, guys got to go quick, girls got to go quick, and the longer you wait, if you're going to go, the hurt, you know, the more it hurts you. So I think we'll have a clear idea of who's staying, who's going, and what that means for each program shortly after the portal opens. So we'll circle back, but until then, you've been listening to the Odds and Audibles podcast.
Talk to you there, folks.